Ms. Alexander, if you could join us. So City Council will come back from recess. You're right here. Our hired outside counsel is going to provide us with just a quick summary of some non-business points. Is that right? Non-financial term points, and then also walk us through the proposed amendments. What I'd like to do, we can either save the amendments for a future vote, or we can just get the amendments incorporated in, which is my preference, but it's a soft preference, so that we just don't lose track of them. And so, Ms. Alexander, if you could take it from here, I'd appreciate it.
Great. Thank you, Mayor. Fellow council members, I'm Dina Alexander, Radler White, Parks and Alexander, outside counsel for the city. As the mayor said, I wanted to point out a few things for you, primarily in the redevelopment agreement, but which flow through the other documents, which I think are key legal points you might be wondering about, thinking about, and otherwise we would be presenting to you on similar type deals. And then I will walk you through the amendments to the documents. So in the redevelopment agreement, and I'll give you section references, so it's in the record should you choose to look at them later, but I wanted to point out the following. One, recital H in the redevelopment agreement sets forth the intent of the parties that the 2% art budget be used for the Memorial Gardens project, which I wanted to point out as it's been discussed in other testimony. In section 4 of the RDA, there are the public goals and objectives set forth. And in particular, section 4.6 of the redevelopment agreement talks about continued community access and says that it should be kept the same as it is today. So the events, OSAA, the other events that have been long traditions at VMC will continue.
Is that a change?
It is not a change. It's an express statement that things will remain as they are with respect to community access.
Thank you.
In section 5.2, there's a provision that says the Hawks will commit to play all of their home games either in the garden or at VMC, and that was important because they wanted to have to know that they had access to be able to play there for 10 years. So in consideration for that, we asked them to also make a commitment to the Rose Quarter over a 10-year period. Hitting on some key construction-type issues, section 11.7 does say that the general construction contract will be a guaranteed maximum price, something that we typically look for in these projects.
I'm sorry, I'm not thinking fast enough. Going back to 5.2, it says
yes,
that the Hawks will play all the home games for 10 years. Why not? I thought the whole deal was that we were trying to get to 20 years.
It is a 20-year deal through the operating agreement that's conditional with between the city and PDC and directly with PAM. And so there will be ability for the Hawks to continue to play. However, what the Hawks have committed to in the RDA in favor of the city commissioner is to play their home games there for 10 years.
But they're not demanding. What are they demanding for 20 years?
So they want the ability to play there for 20 years. What we have not done in return is demand that they commit to play there for 20 years, only for the first 10 years.
Okay, I'll
make sense?
More about that. I understand the concept.
Yeah. So back on some of the key construction items. In Section 12, PAM, as you all know, is acting as the construction manager for the project, sets forth some of their responsibilities in that role, such as enforcing the construction and vendor contracts, taking reasonable efforts to ensure that safety measures are in place during the construction, ensuring that the improvements will be properly integrated into the existing elements in the Coliseum, and causing the construction to be performed in a good and workmanlike manner. So again, typical types of things that we would want to see in this agreement from a construction perspective. There are also provisions in the agreement, section 12.3.2. Each party has a construction representative, including the city. Those construction representatives will participate in all regularly scheduled meetings while the project is being designed and constructed, and they have the right to participate in any and all meetings where there would be material changes to design and construction elements. As you may recall, in December, I believe, of last year, this council exempted PAM from the public procurement process. However, I wanted you to know that in Section 12.5 of the redevelopment agreement, that all of the vendors and the contractors are required to provide payment and performance bonds to support their work on the project. There are also provisions for warranties to protect against defective work. The general contract for construction must have a 2-year warranty, and all other contracts, PAM has agreed to use reasonable efforts to seek 2-year warranties, but there's a minimum of 1 year required, which for many of these types of contracts would be standard.
So 2 years is a pretty standard for a construction contract.
Two years is on the long side, and that's why we've agreed to it in the general construction contract. Would love to have it in all of them, but because of the cost sensitivities around this project, it may not be feasible. But the parties have agreed to try. I wanted to talk a little bit about what is built into the document to support the funding, because the Winterhawks are not funding all of their money up front, nor are they intending to put up a letter of credit to support their funding obligation, and the money's coming in over time as described at the last session. I wanted you to know the protections that are built into the document should they not fund, and the way we've tried to incent to make sure that they do fund. One, there will be a guarantee, a personal guarantee in favor of the city and PDC from the owner of the Winterhawks. If the Hawks fail to fund any of their money timely, the revenue sharing agreement, which is much to their benefit, helping them get some return on their $10 million of investment, would automatically terminate, as would the second 10-year operating agreement, which would give them the ability to play in VMC from 23 to 33. They also lose consent and approval rights that they have under the documentation, and there are immediate defaults that are triggered if they don't fund. So we have tried to build in as much protection as we can around making sure that we get all the money into the project. I wanted to briefly describe to you how cost overruns in this project are dealt with. One, we are carrying a very large project contingency, 20%, through construction. So that's our first line of defense for overruns. PAM has the right to apply that money as they deem reasonable in light of the circumstances if we were to encounter any overruns. PAM then has rights to value engineer the project to get us within budget should they need to do so. And after that, PAM has agreed to take responsibility for cost overruns, except in a situation where an overrun is caused by hidden or unknown environmental conditions that already exist. And those items are dealt with separately through reallocation of budgeted line items, as well as an environmental contingency of $200,000 and another $200,000 of funds that the Spectator Fund has agreed to put up should we encounter unknown environmental conditions in the facility. Finally, in things that flow through the project funding agreement and in the revenue sharing agreement, I wanted you to know that the revenue sharing agreement is expressly subject to the Winterhawks funding all of their money, so they don't get the benefit that they've negotiated in that should they not fund. And in addition, if the Hawks were not to timely fund any portion of their money, the city does not have to approve additional contracts and commit itself to spend more dollars if it would not, in fact, have sufficient resources in the door to do so. So those were the sort of the highlights of things that have not already been discussed in previous testimony I wanted to highlight for you. Certainly encourage any questions or anything else I can answer for you about the documents.
Mary Adams, can I get a sense of what your will is in terms of process? Are we...
Yeah, I talked about it before you came
in. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. So today I just want to have the council put the amendments. Most of them are technical. One has to do with parking that brings it back to council, doesn't make it automatic. I'd like to have council put those into the document, and then there might be more amendments to come, but that way we don't sort of lose track and we give the public, we're able to post the amended documents for the public to comment on.
So we put the amendments in, and then do you have a sense of the timeline for the for resolving the dispute that the Winter Hawks have with the league?
I met with the owner last night and the management team of the Winter Hawks, and I'm going to be conversing, attempt to converse with the league over the next couple days. So I'd just like this to move over to the following week, but we might continue it beyond there, to a week beyond that. So unfortunately, we're not in a position of control over the league's timeline, but I'm going to continue to advocate for resolution before the 19th.
But it would not be your intent to have us vote on this until the issues between the owner of the Winter Hawks and the league are resolved?
I certainly am not interested in forwarding an agreement that I think would fail based on the sanctions that they've levied. Yeah. So it depends on what your definition of resolved is. But
well, my definition would be, as I understand it, the owner of the Winter Hawks has said he will not agree to this deal, given the sanctions that are outstanding. And in reading the responses that we've received last night and have a hard copy of today, the question that's asked, is it possible to complete the renovation deal in the light of the Western Hockey League sanctions against the Portland Winter Hawks? Essentially, the answer is kind of, and however, PDC is not willing to proceed with the deal unless
neither am I. I don't want to engage in hypotheticals. I want to take it one step at a time. I'm going to be talking to the league this week, so I'm not going to bring anything, and the PDC isn't going to agree to anything, and the owner isn't going to agree to anything that we don't feel will make the pro forma. So that's. I'm not being cagey. I just want to talk to the. I think we've all been. All the parties have been clear that the sanctions, as we currently understand them, will not. I'm not comfortable approving this deal with the sanctions not being able to go to playoffs and such. So that conversation is underway. So I can't give you anything more definitive other than I want to continue the discussion next week, and we'll push it off another week if we have to. So. I don't know that I can given the circumstance, anything more definitive than that.
Can I? I want to. Are you the appropriate person to address some questions?
I'd like her to, just so you have it in your mind before we vote on it, sort of have. Dina just went through the non-financial deal points, and then I'd like you to go through the proposed amendments, and then we'll have the whole team available to answer questions on any issue.
Great. So in terms of amendments, first I wanted to talk about item 1367 on today's agenda, which is the package of amendments to the redevelopment agreement and the related documents. These are mostly cleanup and technical in nature, so what I am going to do is just highlight for you a few of the key items. One, and this is a change that happens through in a few different places, there is a neighborhood livability partnership agreement that PAM has entered into with the Elliott Neighborhood and the Lloyd District Community Association. We had omitted, not intentionally, we had omitted the Lloyd District Community Association in the document, so in a few places we have added them. There is another change where, based on the timing of this matter in front of you, we needed to change the timing of when documents would potentially be signed and when some of the documents would actually be finalized. So there is a change in the redevelopment agreement that reflects the realities of what is actually occurring. There is a very minor but important substantive change in the redevelopment agreement and the project funding agreement that clarifies the date by which all of the Hawks funding would be due. And that date, if you might recall from last week's session, is July 1st, 2013. So a clarifying change was made on that in the documents. And in the second amendment to the operating agreement with PAM and in the conditional operating agreement between the city and PDC, we have clarified some insurance provisions that require both property and liability insurance to be carried on certain items. So that's really the meat of the changes in that document. And so we, when and if this is to be voted on, that these amendments would be incorporated into the documents that you would ultimately take action on.
These sound like, the way you've described these amendments, they sound like technical, housekeeping, legal things. They don't sound like they go to the heart of the structure of the deal.
I think that's correct, Commissioner Fish.
And did you go through the PBOT amendment as well?
Right here.
Okay, great.
So the second item, which is 1368 on your agenda today, are the amendments to the option agreement between the city and PDC. And the changes, first I want to note, there were some changes that I think council was presented with last week. I know, Commissioner Fritz, you had some additional changes that you gave to OMF after the meeting. Those are reflected in these changes, is my understanding, so that you're aware of that. And in essence, what these changes do is make it clear that the action on the event parking district will come back to council, and so pulls back a little bit of the authority that was given to the PBOT director, and it makes it clear that there will be some public process around the event parking district, and that it will be brought back to council specifically.
So now we can have questions, Jack or whomever, Betsy, come up for questions on anything and everything.
Well, one of the things, and I appreciate the Q&A that we got on in response to the questions we put in the record at the last hearing. I had a couple of questions off of this. One had to do with the percent for the art, because the answer is very clear, but now I'm even more confused, because I thought someone said that the percent for the art generated by this project would be reinvested at VMC. And the explanation describes how RAC distributes its money and its formula, but it doesn't state that the money will be spent. It says it can be spent on art located in the Memorial Gardens, but it doesn't specify that this money would be spent. And I was operating under the assumption that we were going to use this pool of money to maintain some of the memorial features. So am I wrong on that?
I'm actually going to let Betsy respond to that question.
I think both Dina and I have responses, so I'll let Dina start.
So, Commissioner Fish, because of the, because what the code says in terms of how RAC is mandated in the code to allocate the money, what we did in the document, and I think you were out of chambers when I hit this point, in Recital H of the redevelopment agreement, what we've done is express the intent of all of the parties to the redevelopment agreement that money be spent on the Memorial Garden. My sense is there, and I'll let Betsy address this, there will need to be further conversations with RAC about this specific issue, but all of the parties to the RDA want that money to go to the Memorial Gardens project.
But I'm sorry, and I've talked to RAC.
So if it's our intent to put it into the Memorial Garden, is this restriction on what would qualify for use of the funds, does that apply? Where it could not be used for fountain seating, et cetera?
So I think that part of this depends on how broadly RAC interprets and what their guidelines say, but I did not read the code to prohibit the expenditures on the gardens as the parties to the RDA have envisioned it.
I see.
And I think the intent is that any piece commissioned through the Percent for Art program would complement and enhance the Memorial Gardens and the Veterans Memorial aspect of the building, and would also include veterans in the selection process in some way.
I don't remember us in the past maybe waiving these rules on a specific project, but the council, I guess, is the ultimate arbiter of that.
Correct. Right.
I'll let other people jump in.
Commissioner Salzman.
So on the event parking district proposal, so this will come back to council prior to implementation, or?
Yeah.
It will come back to council for authorization, correct, before any implementation is done and after the public outreach that's already been underway by the Lloyd TMA. with PBOT is concluded.
So is there a, what I'm thinking about is that with the Geldwin parking surcharge,
right.
Council specifically authorized a maximum rate, but any changes beyond that maximum required council approval. So I guess I'm correct. Wondering, do I need to offer an amendment at this point with regard to the $3.50, or
so the
is that something that should wait until a later date?
The document does say that they could increase up to $3.50 per hour for events. So I read it as a cap built into the way that the document has been revised.
Which agenda item is that document under?
So that is 1368. And you should have both red line and cleaned versions of the documents in front of you, Commissioner. And in section, if you are looking at it.
I don't have it, I don't think.
That will come back to you all again.
So any?
But the assumption is it's no more than three.
Can't go higher without council approval. Okay.
You don't have a district right now, so that's not even formulated, but you're sending the message with this amendment that's the highest, at least at the outset, you're willing to tolerate.
Here they are, sorry.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Carla.
So on top, you should have a document that is the red line showing the changes. And if you flip to what is the fourth page, at the top, there's a subsection 2, which talks about the extended meter hours and the rate increases up to $3.50 per hour.
Questions by
while we're going through that, yeah. Jack, can I address a question to you?
Sure.
Before we leave, because I'm looking at that subparagraph 3, and it does talk about modifying meter hours and rates, and
right.
Gives that to the PBOT and TMA. And I guess I would like to suggest that council would have to approve anything above $3.50.
And I think back up in paragraph 2, the very last sentence, Commissioner Saltzman. Says higher rates and extended hours will only apply on event dates. So that up to the $3.50 is only supposed to apply, and this...
No, I mean, I get that part, but it looks like the subparagraph 3 does talk about, leaves the discretion to PBOT director, TMA, or Lloyd TMA to...
Only to propose.
So, Commissioner, if you go back to the previous page, the council directive is amended to direct PBOT's director to prepare for council consideration. So all of this would come back before council.
Okay.
And council could at that time determine whether or not to revise that, modify it, or approve it as submitted.
So the one reason to, because it all has to come back, but one reason to keep it in there by way of signaling common sense is right now we have mechanical meters that are 6 days a week till 10 p.m., I think, 5 or 6 days a week around the convention center right now, which doesn't make a lot of sense, and in my personal opinion, and should be scaled back to something that's a little more variable. But they'll have to bring that all back for your approval.
Jack, could we go to page 4 and 5 of the responses that have been furnished to us, and it starts under the heading of property transfers. And first, I really appreciated the history lesson of how we came into ownership of these properties between 57 and 61 and a city bond measure. So that's how we acquired the land. Can someone just walk me through at the top of page 5 what we have here in terms of fee parcels and development rights parcels? What I just want to make sure I understand is, what's the value of the property and assets that is being proposed to be transferred to PDC in connection with this agreement? And you seem to have two categories. Could someone just walk me through this?
I'm going to start off, and then I'm going to let Betsy do a little bit more on this here. These are actually just what we got out the records. This is really not any assessed value on it. We would have to move, if we decide to move forward, if council decide to move forward with this transfer of land, there would have to be an assessed value done in order to determine exactly what the exact value of the land is. There has been some estimates of land in adjacent to it, some figures. I think PDC had some figures that they had looked at. But right now, we don't have an exact value of it. Right now, we're looking at the Benton lot as far as the assessors, what the assessors has valued at it. It is about $2 million. But I wouldn't tie to these numbers because of the fact that we don't have like a fair market value of them at this time.
Or an environmental assessment.
Yeah.
All right, so among the fee parcels, I guess I understand that. It seems like pretty straightforward. What about under the information under the heading of development rights parcels?
The development rights parcels are ones where, for example, the parking garage parcel, the option agreement doesn't contemplate transferring the land itself to PDC, but rather transferring development rights through a ground lease or other mechanism. So the city would retain ownership. PDC would have the rights to develop on those properties. So that's why they're broken out into two different ways.
That those development rights for 15 years were held by PAM.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Okay, that's helpful. And the mayor, could I just understand? And I'm a little diminished today, so I'm probably a little thicker than normal. What's the reasoning for including the fee parcels, and why is that a fundamental part of the deal and the balance of this deal?
Well, part, I think it's a matter of PDC is taking on additional responsibilities depending on how things happen in the second decade of this agreement. So that's one thing. And they have to be able to, some upfront liability if our private partner doesn't come through. So the land helps backstop PDC's ability because this tax increment district is going away and they've spent in, we put aside the 30 or 20 some percent for housing. So the land is a way for PDC to take on the liability in case our private partner doesn't come through, be able to sell the land, get it, entitle it, and get it ready for market and sell it in a quick way. This is what their core, one of their core proficiencies. So that's up front. Then in the second year, if they end up operating, taking the place of PAM in terms of the operations of Veterans Memorial Coliseum, they also have some assets to bank on and the next 10 years to develop them to their full potential, which the city's general fund or OMF or the Spectator Fund would enjoy some of their success as well as contemplated. That too was contemplated but not spelled out in when PAM had the position and the right to develop for those 15 years. These parcels have not had a recent environmental assessment, so we don't know what's on them. The sooner that the city can get it into redevelopment, smart redevelopment, the more resources we will have to pay its share of Superfund, these parcels, to clean it up if they need to be cleaned up, the sooner that the general fund would get it. But I also think that it's an issue of basic, some basic fairness in the family of bureaus. PDC is a creature of the city. It's running out of TIF money. It has to be entrepreneurial. This is the way that the city of New York, this sort of entrepreneurial development is the way that the city of New York business development department has funds its way. So I think it's just sort of smart. To take the place of PAM and to take ownership with that, given liabilities it's assuming. I also think, the tax rolls say it's $3 million, so it's probably more than that. But a lot of this beyond the Benton block is dribs and drabs. It's going to take a very creative public-private effort to get those some of these smaller, odd-shaped parcels developed, and council and PDC commissioners are going to want to make sure that it's done in a very good way. The other part is, if the value, PDC, when the Bureau of Housing was created, PDC transferred over land and properties about $21 million, and that's on top of, or in addition to the TIF allocation. So, you know, that was a transfer to the general fund. The Bureau of Housing didn't pay for it. In this case, we want to get this developed. We want to get it developed well. It's somewhere between three and whatever million dollars in value. They're separate from the city, but they're part of the city family as well, just like when we separated PDC and housing.
And are they, under this agreement, able to redevelop Benson Block now, or do they have to wait 10 years?
The agreement says that in the first 5 years, they are essentially unable to do any development on the Benton lot unless the city and PAM were to agree to that redevelopment. So there's a lockout essentially for 5 years.
And PAM would have the development rights for that remainder, or does this no?
No. So PAM's development rights have expired.
Okay.
So there's no one currently with development rights.
Except
technically,
the
PDC would have them. They're just not usable really in the first 5 years.
And what's the reason for that?
Because of the need for the parties to determine how the current uses on the Benton lot can be handled in other ways to the satisfaction of PAM to make sure that VMC is still Rose operational.
Festival. So as a practical
matter. I was just saying, and the Rose Festival and everybody else. Yeah.
So as a practical matter, we don't even think it could be done even if we wanted to start tomorrow.
Okay. We've talked around the negotiating table. If something lightning strikes and it's within 5 years, the council can always vote to move faster than 5 years, but it requires a vote to come back, and you get asked the questions like, how's the Rose Festival going to get through and all these other things.
Right. Great. Thank you.
All right. Additional questions? And I'd like to move the amendments for the sake of just banking the technical amendments and the parking amendments. It sounds like there'd be support. So I would like to move the amendments proposed by Ms. Alexander, contained in memo dated this memo, underline and strike out.
Are you moving the amendments to 13, bear with me a second, 1367 and 1368 jointly or separately?
Whatever you advise me to do.
I would advise them separately.
I move the amendments to 1367
first.
And I'll second for the purpose of putting them in the record.
Yeah, we're not voting on the overall record. So it's been moved and seconded. Carla, can you please call the vote?
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
I may have further amendments after I've had time to look these through, but I appreciate the work so far. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Amendments are approved. I now move the amendments for item number
1368.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Carla, can you please call the vote on the proposed motion?
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. All right. Well, I think we just now, this will go naturally to the next council. If we don't have anything, then I'll move it to the council after that. But I think we've pushed the issue, if my colleagues agree, as far as we can today, given what we know and don't know.
Talking about the next council session, not this council.
Next council session.
Or the council after that.
Yeah. Will this be just a regular agenda item in the next?
Correct.
So probably toward the end of the agenda, just so that it.
Yeah, we'll put this not a time certain, but towards the end of the agenda. Okay. Unless lightning strikes and we get a breakthrough, then we can always add time certain later.
So right. Why is it on the next agenda? For what purpose?
Because I have to wait to hear back on the problems that we are having with on the sanctions.
If it's at the end of the agenda, as I understand, it gives the mayor a chance to give us a status report.
Yes.
But we're not putting a time certain or putting it up front so we don't jam the rest of the schedule.
So we'll put it the last item on the agenda and we might continue.
And it's not a second reading. It's another
still meeting. A first reading. Right.
Process.
Thank you. Appreciate all your great work. Thanks
Thank
for
you.
The amendments. Deal points. All right. So, Don, can you please read the title and call the vote for item 1391?
Amend the business license law to increase the owner's compensation deduction maximum for the 2013 tax year. Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz.
Glad we're making the increase that we can. I'm committed to continuing till we fulfill our promise. Aye.
I'm pleased to co-sponsor this. And Mayor Adams, the money at issue is the result of a tax amnesty plan that you proposed. It brought in about $1 million. And a portion of that is now being plowed into increasing the business owner's compensation deduction by $2,000. It gets it to $90,500. It is, I think, heading in the right direction. The council's made a commitment to get it to, I think, about $125,000. But most importantly, it is the kind of targeted tax relief geared to small businesses that allows them to, in 2013, potentially reinvest in their businesses, expand their payroll, find other ways of contributing to success and help the local economy. And I think it's it puts us, it's another step in the right direction, and I'm pleased to support it. Thank you. Aye.
Adams.
It is a small but important step. I think it returns to businesses, what, 600,000? How much was it? Andrew,
talking to you.
My big giant head on the screen scares you, and you, okay. What? I think it's about 600,000 total. All right, vote aye. Can you please read items 1393 and 1394? One at a time, 1393,
transmit fiscal year 2013-14 general fund five-year financial forecast.
I just want to make a few opening comments before I turn it over to both Josh and Andrew Jack Graham, Chief Administrative Officer for the city. During the work session, we had gave you some preliminary information regarding the forecast, and at the time we had looked at it, there was a deficit that we need to fill about $24.5 million. Josh is going to go through some of those changes that has occurred since that time. Nothing major significant of those changes, but we're still facing some major challenges as we look through the forecast. And a lot of the factors that we explained to you the last time are still prevalent at this time. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Josh.
All right. Thanks, Jack. For the record, Josh Harwood, City Economist for City of Portland. As you can see in the document in front of you, we're looking at about $25 million in ongoing costs to match ongoing revenue with ongoing expenses for the next 5 years. Almost all of that deficit can be attributed to the three things we've already talked to you about, which are the budget notes, the library levy, the impact we have on property taxes, and the Department of Justice report and the expenses associated with it, conforming to that. The other changes to the forecast generally cancel each other out. Property taxes are down a little bit further still. Business license tax, that forecast we altered just slightly down. Transient lodging is up. State shared revenues are up. Turns out raising liquor prices in Washington means that people cross the border and buy them in Oregon, and that helps us out. So that's the general gist of what we're looking at. We do not have any one time in the forecast as of right now. However, should the pending intergovernmental agreement with the county go through regarding the Sellwood Bridge and delaying the bonding on that, we will see some one time in the forecast resulting from that. Other than that, you know, we do have some broad risks that that we're looking at that are relatively near term. Most notably, our labor contracts that are up for negotiation by the end of this fiscal year. Pretty much every major contract is going to be open, with the exception of the fire contract, which was just recently ratified. I know you've been here for a long time, so I won't take up too much more of your time. The other major difference that we incorporate into this forecast is a different assumption of what the ending balance would be at the end of the year. Historically, bureaus have only spent about 97% of their allocated budget, and the rest has fallen to balance. Well, through budget cuts and squeezing the budgets in the last couple of years, last year that number came up to almost 99%. And so what we've done, that coupled with now we're grabbing vacancy savings in the current year, some of which would have fallen to balance, we're lowering the assumption of how much the ending balance will be every year in the forecast. And that impacts how much resources you have every year in the forecast to the tune of about $4 or $5 million. Finally, I would just like to say this in terms of what we're looking at. again, most of the deficit we're seeing are attributable to non-economic factors. So we probably shouldn't, and in fact, I would argue shouldn't at all, think that the economy can save us from it. We're in a situation where we're expecting growth in the economy. We're expecting revenue growth. This is very different from 3 or 4 years ago, where we were trying to reach for the bottom and fuel out the bottom of our revenue trough. We will see revenues fall next year, but again, that's because of the library levy. That's not a function of a depressed economy. So with that, I'm happy to delve into more specifics and answer any questions.
I also appreciate the point that you made that 90-something percent of the ongoing hole that we have to deal with in the next fiscal year was a function of either the library district, the Department of Justice settlement, and the budget notes. So these are non-economic factors. And I'm somewhat unforeseeable, I think, in fairness, but it's the hand we're dealt. So thank you.
Any other discussion from council? Does anyone wish to testify on this matter? Is this a report? What is this? Resolution?
It's a report.
Report. I move to accept the report.
Second.
So moved and seconded. Carly, can you please call the vote on the motion to accept the report?
Mm-hmm. Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz.
Thank you for all your work. Aye.
Bish.
Aye.
Adams.
Aye. So approved. Can you please read the title for item number 1394?
Capital Improvement Plan Task Force 1 Year Status Update Report to Council.
This is a very quick update we will do in about 60 seconds, but Lisa Shaw has been our head on improving the capital reporting for the city.
Hi, I'm Lisa Shaw with Financial Planning. As part of the 11-12 adopted budget, Council directed FPD to work with a group of citizens and Infrastructure Bureau employees to improve the transparency of the budget document and the process around CIP or capital improvement projects. We met last year, and the task force put together a report which we submitted to you. They had 6 recommendations, and then they asked to meet again 1 year later. So we met in October. They wanted to review what had been implemented and if they were supportive of the results. Very briefly, the recommendations included having a project threshold of $500,000 so that there were not as many large roll-up projects, creating summary table of inter-bureau projects, flagging new projects, including revenue sources and original budget costs, as well as updated budget costs. And there were a few others as well. All of our recommendations were either implemented for this last adopted budget or are in progress and will be implemented in time for the 13-14 adopted budget. The task force was very pleased with the progress so far, and they wished to reiterate their support, and they continue to strive for increased transparency and clarity in the CIP process. They asked for Council's continued support for the recommendations, and they wish to continue to provide input over the next year. FPD intends to brief the mayor-elect and commissioner-elect after they've taken office. And the Council report before you, it consists of just a 2-page memo of the update and then the original report.
Discussion with Council. Does anyone wish to testify on item number 1394?
No one signed up.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Carly, can you please call the vote?
Mm-hmm. Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Please thank the task force for their report and ask them to continue their work. Aye.
Bish?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. So approved. Can you please read the title for resolution item number 1400?
Suspend system development charges for parks and recreation, environmental services, transportation, and water for the construction of accessory dwelling units or the conversion of structures to accessory dwelling units until July 31, 2016.
Thank you, Mayor. Matt Grum with Commissioner Dan Saltzman's office. It's a pleasure to, on his behalf, to bring this resolution forward. We had a very similar resolution, exactly the same resolution, actually, just a few years ago, and it has worked incredibly well. Basically, first fiscal year 2008-2009, when this program was not in place, the Bureau of Development Services permitted 31 accessory dwelling units. And then the first full year that the program was in place, they permitted 70 accessory dwelling units. And actually, for the first time ever last year, they hit the three-digit mark with 104 accessory dwelling units permitted. So it is actually working exceedingly well, and this will extend it for another 3 years, and urge your support.
Can you do, what was it, do you know what the number was before we did this, did you say?
Yeah, so basically, and we can give you the average too. So before we did this, we had 31 in fiscal year 2008-2009. That was 2.6 a month. And then last year we hit 104, and that's 8.7 per month. And actually this year we're on track at 12.8 per month. So we'll probably, you know, hit around 130 this year.
That's awesome. Good work.
Hey, Matt, since you're here and, you know, Brendan always tries to steal your thunder, it's nice to see you get the credit you deserve.
Thank you very much, Commissioner.
And take a bow. This came up a couple of years ago. We were talking about the trade-offs and why. Could you just give us like a 30-second primer on why you think this is strongly in the public interest and what's the benefit?
Well, as we know, as a council, you have many goals and many policies we put in place. And obviously, creating a dense, livable environment, good use of land, keeping our urban growth boundary strong, this really supports all of that. We also are learning with the economy, the cost of utilities, the cost of lifestyles are changing. People are looking actually more and more at smaller footprints, smaller homes. Becoming kind of a micro-home movement. There was actually a conference at PSU just about a month ago on this, and it was well-attended, and more people are really looking at this as a kind of a niche market that's growing. So for all those, it's really shown it's a good policy and needs to continue.
And that notwithstanding, no matter your age or station in life, you never know, you might need one of these accessory dwelling units.
True enough.
And there was rampant.
Than living in the garage.
That's right.
And the other benefit that you alluded to is that previously, there was sort of rampant noncompliance with the law, and now we have people taking out permits. We have an ability to make sure that the work is done safely and to code, and that's another advantage for us.
Absolutely. Good point.
Thank you.
All right. Anyone wish to testify on this matter?
Yes. We had one person sign up, Eli Spivak.
Mr. Spivak, thanks for your patience today with our way beyond.
That's understandable. Okay. So thank you, guys. I was here 3 years ago, and I'm excited you're taking this on right now. Just a couple notes. I won't repeat what Matt's already said. I think that Portland's real leader in this. That summit a month ago, over 300 people attended from regionally, and they were excited by Portland's leadership on this. Eugene is working on doing an SEC waiver like this for their accessory dwelling unit code, and a lot of people are looking to Portland for this. I think that in a city where we have a lot of forms of infill density that are not appreciated, some little skinny homes or big, huge, bulking things, accessory dwelling units are really palatable. And so I hope that the city continues to encourage the kind of infill that people are happy to support. I think that as the city goes through its comp plan process, I hope that we can bring forward more ways to encourage people to build smaller homes. And there are a lot of good ideas on that. I hope those will get to the city council. And lastly, I'll say I hope that during this waiver period, the city can look seriously at and direct staff to investigate this to make system development charges scale based on house size. Currently, you pay the same SDCs on a 1,000-square-foot house as you pay on a 5,000-square-foot house. I think that long-term, I know that other cities are starting to look at this also, for a fairness perspective, there should be some scaling. Not that you'd pay five times more than, you know, but something like that. And in the interim, though, I'm excited that this measure looks likely to pass, and thank you very much for supporting it.
Great. All right. Carla, can you please call the vote on item 1400 resolution?
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Well, thanks to Matt Grimm for bringing the report. It's important when we do tax measures to look back and see did it work. Did it work as intended? And indeed, this has. And so even 130 new units in the city is not that many, and we want people to know that this systems development charge waiver is in place, that it can make development much more affordable. When Dr. Mark Bellow of the Bureau of Development Services did the initial survey regarding how many accessory dwelling units we have in our neighborhoods, at least a decade ago, I would think, I didn't even know where the ones in my neighborhood were. They're so well done, which I take some pride in because I was part of the development of the standards while on the Planning Commission. So it's good to see something that government has done that is working well for developers, for construction workers, for citizens and residences, and as well as for us getting more things done. Aye.
Fish.
Randy, I think, first brought this forward, and Dan is continuing it, and I think it's good policy. And to Eli's point that you made, the council did change SDCs for the single-family developer so that you didn't have to pay them up front. You could defer them and pay them at the point of sale. Parks Bureau is just launching an SDC review, which we do every, I think, 5 years or something, and there's some lots of ideas about how our fee system might be more tailored, and love for you to weigh in during that. And the mayor-elect was pretty vocal during the campaign about wanting to look at SDCs more broadly. So I think there'll be an opportunity to look at some of those questions, including whether it should be scaled to the size of the home. This is good policy. I'm pleased to support it. Aye.
Adams.
Great leadership, Commissioner Randy Leonard, and great follow-on-ship and promotion of the policies to Commissioner Saltzman and his team. Thank you very much. Aye. Can you please read the title for item number 1401?
Replace the sewer user charges code for consistency of definitions, clarification of terms, and addition of enforcement measures.
Who is here to, Amy? Did the Bureau staff just get up? They were tired of waiting.
Hi, Mayor, Commissioners. I'm Amy Truman, Dan Saltzman's office. BES worked with the city's, with the city attorney's office to do these code changes. It's basically a housekeeping ordinance where we cleaned up a lot of language, updated some parts of the code.
Great.
Question?
Yes.
The only underline I have in my document is the definition of slug load, which I found very interesting. But I'm wondering before the second reading next week if I could get an underline, red line copy to find out what the changes are. And I don't know if we need a resolution to say that we should do that as a matter of course, or if the city auditor could just always ask for an underline strikeout copy when we have especially complex changes like the housekeeping. But I don't know which of them are.
Sure, we can get the revisions for you and then the definition of slug load as well.
Okay, does anyone wish to testify on this matter? All right, moves to further consideration next week. Can you please read the title for non-emergency ordinance 1402?
Mm-hmm. Authorized grant agreement with Friends of Zenger Farm to support the Bureau of Environmental Services mission of providing environmental education and promoting environmental stewardship.
That's true.
Zenger Farm is in the Lentz neighborhood, very well-known organization. It sits on 9 acres that it leases from the city. And Friends of Zenger Farm is the nonprofit arm. They operate a sustainable urban agriculture farm that promotes environmental education and stewardship, and they've been longtime partners with BES. So this ordinance authorizes grants from the city of up to $10,000 a year for 3 years to support their education and environmental stewardship programs.
Discussion with council. Does anyone wish to testify on this matter?
No one signed up.
Moves to further consideration at City Council next week. We're in recess till
next week. Pulled item.
Oh, sorry, pulled item.
Okay, 1390. Certify abstract of votes cast, proclaim candidates elected and measured approved at the municipal nonpartisan general election held in the city of Portland on November 6, 2012.
Is the person who pulled it in the room?
We had three people who want to testify.
Oh, okay, great.
Nancy Newell, Catherine Lambert Holenstein, and Rosemary Up.
Thanks for your perseverance. It's been a long day. Who would like to begin?
I'll start when I situate myself.
Again, state your name and if you're representing yourself or somebody else.
Breathe for a second. Catherine Lambert Holenstein. We are concerned with the election certification today of the mayoral candidate-elect. Charlie Hales was not a legally qualified voter when he filed an application for that position. Therefore, he was not a legally qualified candidate and should not be certified today. Hales has called this ridiculous. When he moved to Washington, he was not in the military, nor was he in college. His job did not require him to change residency, nor did he move away to give assistance to an elderly family member, friend, relative. There are no special circumstances in his case. If one moves from apartment 10 to apartment 15, one has to update the registration or re-register. That is a requirement. Right here on, we all got the voter's pamphlet recently, right here on page M3, each time you move, you must update your registration. They've made it easier because now we can do it on computers, except me. I'm still a Luddite, but you know, most of the rest of you can do that. I signed up this morning as Catherine, my legal name, because I wanted to make a point. If I sign my ballot envelope, Cherry, which is a nickname that I've had since I've been 3 days old, my ballot would not be legal, therefore my vote would not be counted. It's that simple. There are election laws, and either these laws apply to all of us, or we ask, are some people above the law? Knowing that you are a lawmaking body who frequently pass laws that we all must adhere to, may we assume that you will not place Charlie Hales above the law? I'm always scribbling at the last minute. Then just let me make one quick point. If I still have some time. During the HUAC, House American Activities Committee, and the Joseph McCarthy abominable hearings and all, Archibald MacLeish, I believe he was the editor of Harper's Magazine at that time, the early 50s, and he said very simply, the true test of democracy is in its use. There is no other test. Please use that today. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi. My name is Rosemarie Opp. There has been a letter submitted from several residents into the record who have been concerned about any certification of this November 6, 2012 election. The letter has been put into the record along with a complaint that was filed by a Seth Ellen Woolley that alleges that Charlie Hales was unlawfully registered and therefore not qualified to have been on the ballot as a candidate for the mayor of the city of Portland. The complainant alleges that Charles Hales, one, unlawfully voted in Oregon several times since the beginning of 2004, two, unlawfully registered to vote in Oregon in 2008, three, made false swearings on his voter registration card filed in March 18 of 2008, four, made false swearings in signing each of his vote-by-mail envelopes submitted in Oregon since the beginning of 2004, and five, violated the Portland City Code 2.08.050 and Portland City Charter 2-202, and is not legally qualified to be a candidate for the mayor of Portland or to serve in that office. That document has been, the 18-page document has been put into the record. Our recently elected Attorney General, Ellen Rosenblum, has stated, the integrity of Oregon elections is of paramount importance. This is about our very important election process and the integrity of our 2012 election. We insist that these allegations that Mr. Hales was not legally qualified when he filled out the mayoral application to be investigated before certification process continues. The confidence that Oregonians have in their elections is important, and this matter and the law cannot be brushed aside. Thank you.
Hi.
Hi, my name is Nancy Newell. I'm in full support of all the testimony in Seth Woolley's filing. The Secretary of State has sat on this for about 2.5 months, so there will be further action. But I would request that the city auditor, under the guidance of the City Council, seriously address this issue, because you as designated elected city council members should follow the charter, city charter code, and assure the public that every fair process that people live by every day in this city, over a million people, it should be required of someone that runs for office in our city. And that's why I'm here today, to ask you that you ask for a full review, a legal review. There are several recourses we have to pursue this, but why waste taxpayer money in removing someone from office that potentially legally could be removed from office? I can't see going ahead today with your vote on certification. And I'll just give you an example. My mother was city treasurer. She got $75 a month. And a very ambitious city manager replaced her.